each year we can track our progress instead of, I think, what we've seen in the past in local government. We create plans that have these big lofty goals, and then you're like, okay, well, how do you know when you're supposed to have that accomplished? Like, what is our benchmark for when you should be done?
Well, welcome back to the Public Money Pod, a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. And we are, of course, proudly sponsored by the Government Finance Officers Association, MuniPro, Odyssey Advisors, and Build America Mutual. I'm Justin Marlowe, joined, as always, by my intrepid co-host, fiscal policy expert, Marylander, Californian, Liz Farmer. Liz, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Always happy to be here, even on an April Fool's Monday. That is no joke. we just celebrated Easter here this past weekend, and there was a challenge the Easter Bunny faced this year with finding candy for a child that just got braces. So I had no clue about this, but the internet has all kinds of information on what kind of candy you can eat with braces. So thank goodness for that.
Yes, I the struggle is real. Having been in orthodontia about age 4 through about age 18, I get it. It is, but I think it seems like there's a lot more options now than there might have been back in the day.
Yes, so that's yes, there are.
good. Well, all the best on this and future Easters as an ongoing challenge. So we want to do a couple things here at the top of the episode. Our episode today is featuring a really great guest, Genesis Gavino, who is the chief of staff and the resilience officer for the city of Dallas, Texas, doing some really, really interesting work, some really comprehensive work on all things related to resilience, not just climate, but economic opportunity, in addition to dealing with all of the attendant issues around resilience, everything from connectivity to housing affordability to you name it. And so Dallas really has emerged as a leader in this space. And these are, of course, big dollar concerns. Anytime we get into embedding values like resilience and sustainability into a very large city government, it becomes a lot of zeros very, very quickly. So we're going to hear a lot from Genesis on the work that they're doing and the way that it has big implications, we think, for public money. So we look forward to that discussion and issues that we talk about a lot here on the pod, and we could probably spend all day talking about, but want to just make clear that that's where we're going to go with the rest of the discussion. But before we do that, we're actually, as Liz said, recording this on April 1st, less than a week following the Baltimore Key Bridge collapse. And Liz, you put out a really wonderful special, long story short, focused specifically on the Key Bridge collapse. And you'd know a lot about this, being a longtime resident of the area and having covered city government in that part of the world, covering state government in that part of the world. This is going to be a very big public money question, as the federal government has pledged to become involved, and as I think a lot of people are going to see the way that states and cities and counties and the federal government work together, or don't work together in some cases, and the way that the money flows through that system, it's going to be really interesting to watch. Tell us a little bit more about what you had to say about that and where you see this issue going.
Yeah, there's so many questions, and I, like a lot of people, am still just kind of in shock that this is something that happened. I mean, I was thinking about, in terms of public infrastructure and public investments, bridges, there's something magical about them. And so when something like this happens, it's even more of a shock because of that kind of emotional value that we tend to tie to bridges. But certainly, I think the biggest immediate questions are around the port of cleanup and the port of Baltimore. That, to me, and I wrote about it, is the biggest potential economic hit to the state of Maryland, to the Mid-Atlantic, to the port industry. I've learned a lot about the port of Baltimore in the last week, and it handles some of the large. It's one of the few ports on the East Coast that can handle the world's largest cruise ships. It is the closest one to the Midwest. It's basically the gateway to the Midwest. It's within an overnight drive of a third of the population. So this is no and it's closed right now because of all the debris, and we don't know when it's going to reopen. And it's not just shipping, it's crabbers, kind of a big industry in Maryland, and other small businesses. So the closure of that port is going to, and already has had, an economic ripple effect. And talking about resiliency, supply chain resiliency, what's going to happen in the meantime? Baltimore is, I think, the number one port in the nation for autos, trucks, cargo on wheels, basically. And so that's just a big, big thing that we don't know a lot about yet. We just know it's going to take some time to work out. And then for the state of Maryland, for the port, you know, that business is going elsewhere for the time being. Is that business going to come back? What about the thousands of jobs that rely on that port? So the state is looking at economic relief, emergency legislation. The lawmakers want to authorize the governor to be able to tap the state's rainy day fund to pay for some of this relief. They want to be able to, much like we did in COVID during the pandemic, expand unemployment insurance to non-traditional employees or non-traditional workers. So not just W-2 employees, but to all the independent contractors and folks like that who are not otherwise eligible for unemployment insurance. And those are all good things. The flag I kind of raised too is that Maryland's already facing a budget shortfall. We talked about it on the last Public Money Pod. So this is going to squeeze that. We don't know how just yet, but it's another pressure that lawmakers rightfully now have to pivot to and really focus on. But there's still this long-term impact of the state is spending more money than it's making, and that needs to be fixed. So that's another issue. And then the state has received $60 million right now from the federal government. There's a relief fund from the federal government that can pay for the entirely for cleanup and that sort of thing. But in regards to the final cost of the bridge, I saw one estimate of $1 billion. I tried to compare that with more recent bridge developments and saw that the Governor Mario M. Cuomo Bridge in New York, that formerly the Tappan Zee, that bridge is about twice as long as the one in Baltimore. But the cost for that was $4 billion. So I think $1 billion plus is a really safe estimate. And then considering the amount of time it might take before construction actually starts, that cost is going to go up for sure. So, and how much the federal government can ultimately pay for. Now, the feds have said, the president has said that he wants the government, feds, to pay for all of it. But that requires Congress to approve it. The fund that they're tapping right now for that emergency relief for Maryland only has actually, it feels weird to say only $1 billion, but when you're talking about infrastructure for the nation, that doesn't go too far. So still, you know, it'll require an act of Congress, and we all know that Congress doesn't always agree on these things. So still a lot up in the air, but as you mentioned early on, there's a lot of zeros we're talking about here and commas. So it's something that is going to develop over the course of months and years. And it's a very, very big deal for Maryland and East Coast port industry in general.
This really raises questions too about all indications at this point are that there was nothing nefarious happening here, but it does raise the question of the vulnerability of some of these infrastructure assets to a deliberate attack. And speaking of resilience, of course, our theme for today, it seems like that's going to be a part of the discussion around this bridge. Is if you're going to rebuild, do you rebuild with the same design that may be vulnerable to a deliberate attack at some point in the future? And that raises the same question for the dozens of very major infrastructure assets that have similar design features to this one. And this raises a whole range of questions, the things that we've known for a while in the infrastructure space that people talk about a lot, the vulnerability of key infrastructure assets to natural disasters, deliberate attacks, accidents, whatever it might be. But you can't help but think a little bit about, okay, should you do it differently? Should you design it differently to make it more resilient? But at what cost? And at what additional time and opportunity cost, you know, that'll come with taking more time to develop and taking more time to build? And the clock is ticking, undoubtedly. Well, we're pleased to welcome to the Public Money Pod Genesis Gavino, who is the Chief of Staff and Climate Resilience Officer at the City of Dallas, Texas. Genesis, welcome to the Public Money Pod.
Thank you, Dr. Marlowe.
Yeah, welcome. We're talking about something that I just find extremely fascinating because there's so many different kind of ways that a climate officer, a chief resilience officer, and a chief of staff, I mean, you're not doing a small amount of things here. So can you tell us a little bit about your role in the city of Dallas and how'd you find your way there?
Yeah, of course. And so, like you said, I serve as chief of staff and resilience officer for the city of Dallas. I was actually, before I served as chief of staff, I was resilience officer in the Office of Equity and Inclusion. And so a lot of my work has been the implementation of the Resilient Dallas strategy. But backing up way back is how I ended up here, right? It's I think a lot of the work that I have done in the past has been focused on addressing some of the needs of our most vulnerable populations. Out of my master's program, I went to work for the city of Tacoma as a management fellow. And some of the work that I did there was looking at homelessness. And then moving from Tacoma to Dallas, Texas, I focus on a whole host of issues, most of them leading to the work of the Resilient Dallas, or what was formerly the Office of Resilience. And then we combined several different divisions or offices to create the Office of Equity and Inclusion, which is then where the Resilient Dallas strategy was housed, and thinking about how we address resilience in the city of Dallas by focusing on equity for our most vulnerable populations, and not just looking at it from a climate adaptation, climate perspective, but really a more holistic and urban resilience perspective.
Well, that's really interesting to hear. Genesis, when certainly for a lot of us who follow local government, when we think of places that are leading on resilience, you might think of a Seattle or Dallas or Boston or someplace like that. Dallas may or may not come to mind as a leader on resilience, but I think it's fair to say that the Environmental Climate Action Plan that you mentioned is certainly a leading document, certainly one that people talk about a lot. Tell us a little bit more about kind of the underlying motivation for that. You mentioned that it involved combining a bunch of different departments under a broader mandate, but give us a little bit more of the kind of behind the scenes as to how this became a priority and why you went about doing it the way you did.
Of course. And, don't hold it against us that we are a city within the state of Texas. We can still do great things, right? And going back to our participation in resilient in the 100 Resilient Cities program, which was led by the Rockefeller Foundation, went from, I think, 2016 to about 2019, 2020. We were in the second tranche of cities selected across the globe to participate and develop our own resilience plan. And so ours obviously focused broadly. We subscribe to the broad definition of urban resilience, right? So it's like survive, adapt, and thrive in the face of man-made and natural disasters, right? So shocks and stressors. So Dallas wrote and developed our plan that built off of a report that was written about the drivers of poverty in Dallas, right? So it's not really, it's not looking at just urban heat island effect or what are those natural climate disasters that are happening that really drive some of the issues that we see, but it looked at it more from the perspective of, okay, we're dealing with systemic poverty in Dallas. What are the ways that we can focus our efforts and be resilient towards that? And so out of that, we come with 7 goals, one being focusing on advancing equity in local government. Number 2 is being a welcoming city for immigrants and refugees. 3 is looking at economic mobility. 4 is about equitable transportation. 5 is building healthy communities. 6 is that housing infrastructure. And then 7 is our environmental sustainability, looking to really improve public health and alleviate adverse environmental conditions, right? So as we dig into goal 7, we have 2 main activities there. It's support and leverage our academic institutions so that we can fill some of the gaps of what we don't know of what's happening in Dallas as it relates to environmental sustainability. And so from that, we conducted air quality assessments, and then we did an analysis of flood and drainage in the city of Dallas. And then finally, the second action or second focus area is really promoting partnerships or efforts to implement green infrastructure projects in our neighborhoods that are disproportionately vulnerable to the impacts of our urban heat island effect, poor water quality and then also poor air quality. From that action or that initiative came the Cool, Clean, Resilient Dallas report, which really set us up for kind of thinking about how do we make this much broader, right? So we think about Resilient Dallas as really that foundational work for the Comprehensive Environmental Climate Action Plan, or we, as we know it here locally, the CCAP. Building off of what Goal 7's actions, we have a full-fledged plan of CCAP, which was adopted in 2020 on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. 8 goals. And then we have, within those 8 goals, there are like 97 actions that are consistent with the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. All of those goals, they have yearly work plans that ensure that we're advancing towards various initiatives that we set out in this comprehensive document, right? So I think we're now into year four. So we have 3 years of work that we've, you know, we can point to and say, yes, we've done X, Y, and Z that gets us to accomplishing whatever initiative is listed under the building goal, right? So each year we can track our progress instead of, I think, what we've seen in the past in local government. We create plans that have these big lofty goals and then you're like, okay, well, how do you know when you're supposed to have that accomplished? Like, what is our benchmark for when you should be done? Instead, what we did with CCAP is, okay, every year, this is what you can expect from the city and our partners to accomplish various goals to get us to those, obviously Paris Climate Agreement, and then all of the various initiatives and actions that we have in CCAP itself.
I've been taking notes as you've been talking, and you sort of addressed the question that immediately popped up, because I just wrote down, for example, air, food, water, energy, transportation, health, economic opportunity, infrastructure, and I've probably missed some categories here, but this is not just like a climate change thing. As you've said, this is a how everything kind of connects together sort of plan, and it does have those different sort of levels, but maybe you can tell us a little bit more, and maybe perhaps just with an anecdotal example of like how it's so much. How do you kind of piece it apart and make it manageable and digestible and keep that feeling of, yes, we are making progress?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? Because I think any comprehensive plan can seem daunting to any one department, but then let alone an entire organization. I think we approach how we work on the CCAP the same way we approach like our racial equity plan as a great example, is that it is embedded in all of the work that we do. You can look at one action in the racial equity plan and it'll specifically call out, this also shows up in the CCAP, right? And then coming up soon, we have our Dallas Housing Policy 2033. We're very, very specifically looking at racial equity initiatives for our housing vulnerable populations, right? And so that ties into how are we building green infrastructure, but then also creating enabling technology within homes that are being built so that that future homeowners can then be ready for future technology, right? I'm thinking first of like EV charging in the home. We talk about how EV charging can be a barrier for, you know, low-income households, but there's a push for people to buy EVs. But if you can't charge it at home and you don't have the public infrastructure to charge it, then it becomes a moot point. So we look at it from the perspective, how are we then creating that, you know, making it a policy priority for us to look at future development to be already wired, pun intended, for EVs. And so that, you know, you don't have to go and spend thousands of dollars just to put in a 240 volt, you know, plug in your home. And then another one I'm thinking about is like our parks department, right? I know this is a touchy subject in other parks departments across the country, but how are we incentivizing the use of battery operated lawn equipment, right? Versus the gas power that then emits into the atmosphere. And it's just not good for workers who have to work close to them, or, you know, use them daily, but then also for the environment. And so thinking about those ways where it's not just one department really implementing this plan, but it is truly the work, and it is embedded across all 43 departments at the city, and how we think about our connectivity and intersection of their work, whether you're housing, whether you're parks department, with our CCAP plan, and then also like our racial equity. And I think it really boils down to, because we have such a focus here in this organization of leading with empathy, ethics, excellence, and equity.
I'm curious about the real strong emphasis in this plan on climate adaptation. Like Justin mentioned, a lot of times we think about climate change, we think of the more coastal cities. What motivated Dallas to put such a strong emphasis on it? Are we just overlooking the fact that Dallas gets a lot of rain, or is it, you mentioned economic mobility. What are the kind of linkages there that you can explain for us?
They're all linked together, right? When we look at our ability to quote unquote bounce back from a natural disaster or a man-made event, or whether it's a shock or stressor. I mean, Dallas, unfortunately, has witnessed, and even in my last 7 years here, some really crazy weather, from freak ice storms. And then we had a tornado. I think we've had two tornadoes come through, costing us $2 billion in damages, right? And then we had I think it was last year or the year before, a 100-year rainfall happened in a matter of a few hours, flooding, I think it was East Dallas, neighborhoods in East Dallas. And nobody really expected that. How are we marshaling all of our resources together to then support people to respond to that, right, and survive and adapt from those disasters? But then also, how do we prepare ourselves for that future? And then recognizing, like you said, our economic future, what does that look like if we can't even secure housing, right, and protect them from heavy rainfall or the flooding that does occur? So all of this does, you know, it all connects together, because if you can help communities survive, adapt, and thrive, then they will be more economically stable. And then it leads to having that stable workforce, right? And then you can have infrastructure that can withstand whatever it is, the natural disaster, that then people that will contribute to the environment as opposed to take away. So it's all of those different connecting pieces that we look at, and why we have that strong emphasis on climate adaptation.
You said a little bit ago, Genesis, that you're collecting a lot of data. You've got dozens and dozens of different measurable indicators on all of these different goals. We've talked often on this podcast about environmental social governance, ESG reporting, making that kind of information available to municipal bond investors and taxpayers and others who are in the public money sphere. As I understand it, Dallas has been doing some of that, and it would seem a short walk from the kinds of things you're doing to making that information available for investors and others. Is that, tell us a bit about your experience with what we might call ESG disclosure for municipal bonds.
Yeah, you know, it's really surprising that I don't think they talk about it as much, but when we do bond issuances, right, obviously there's that letter that goes in front and tells all about our projects and everything and our priorities and all that. For the last 7 years, Dallas has really been intentional about leading with our values. And I reiterate them. So they're empathy, ethics, excellence, engagement, and equity. Internally, we recognize that across all the work that we do. And how do then externally, how do we communicate that? That shows up in the policies, programs, and priorities that we fund. And so when our treasury department, who does all of our issuances and puts out the letters and all that stuff, is able to demonstrate and say, hey, yes, these projects all align, and we can point to a specific racial equity, you know, performance measure, or a housing plan measure, or our CCAP goal, then that gets to some of those ESG measurements, right? Last year, we were one of six cities across the nation chosen to participate in this inaugural cohort facilitated by the National League of Cities, to really look at the way we understand equity considerations in the issuance of municipal bonds, which really came for us at a great time, because at that time we were developing our now 2024 bond program, which right now is going to be about $1.2 billion, which will go towards various infrastructure programs, right, such as or projects such as city facilities, streets, wastewater and sewer, and parks. So we join this cohort, right, and essentially we get technical assistance in how we can develop novel equity strategies or frameworks for municipal bonds. Now, knowing that we already talk about some of our ESGs in our issuance and stuff, it's like we took it a step further and like really how do we integrate, because then for our 2024 bond program, we actually did create equity target areas, which is how they then prioritize which projects made it to the top or which were like the selected by our bond task force and then it's eventually our city council, which bond projects would be part of the entire bond program. The equity priority areas were chosen using different criterias from, you know, looking at vulnerable neighborhoods, using criteria obviously set by our racial equity plan, our CCAP, our housing plan, and then also looking at air quality. Already investors can look at, you know, what is the whole package and say that we've put thought into what goes into this program and that it's not just, you know, the biggest project or whatever that is being put forward. People can dig deeper or investors can dig deeper and know more about what our priorities are because we're very transparent about that of like how everything connects to various strategies, plans, programs, and initiatives that council, you know, has approved or that the city has been intentionally working on over the last 7 years. And so I think that our, you know, one, our participation in the cohort has really helped us, you know, for our next bond program, but then also providing, being able to provide peer-to-peer learning for other cities who are like, okay, we're not even close to that step of being able to talk about ESG, you know, in our issuances and being able to share how we're able to do that again in the state of Texas. Recently, I think it's a school district in Austin or Houston. I might be wrong on that, but like our attorney general is actually suing to prevent bond sales that focus on ESG, or there's something that they passed mm-hmm. recently that prevent us from selling to investors who have an ESG focus. And they were able to quantify what that opportunity cost is for the school district. And I might be wrong if it's the school district or the city, but like costing millions, right? So like in the absence of being able to do that, this is what it's gonna cost taxpayers. This is what, you know, the impact on future infrastructure. We're all eager to see kind of like what happens there because then that, you know, that trickle effect of how's this going to impact our ability to issue bonds. We haven't seen it yet, but that's not to say that they don't do something, you know, tricky down there at the state legislature.
Yeah, so that's I'm really glad you kind of laid that out because I think when we hear about that news in Texas and the pushback from state level officials and the legislature on that focus on even focusing on ESG investments, what I'm hearing from you is that for the cities, it's not actually deterring you from still moving forward and talking and planning because, like it or not, these things are still a thing. And Dallas, you all are a member of several local government climate adaptation clubs. For example, the Resilient Cities Network and the Resilient City Network's global steering committee. Are you kind of getting some lessons learned from being a part of that? Or are there some other kind of bonus impacts of being part of a group like that that Dalek's taxpayers can benefit from?
High level, the Global Steering Committee essentially is made up of two representatives from each of the regions that are part of the Resilient Cities Network. So we have North America, Asia Pacific, and then we have the Africa region, and then we have Europe and Middle East, and then we have Latin America. So we have about 10 representatives, and all of us serve as like the region representatives are all a CRO or chief resilience officer or similar role. And we represent essentially each of our regions and kind of filter back up to the global steering committee, kind of like what are we seeing as priorities in our region and uplifting that so that the essentially, I guess, like the curricula for the network reflects what we're seeing in each of our regions. And I think this is really important because what I've found really interesting is that obviously we all have our different challenges, right? Our North America cohort or region, I think there's about 28 cities represented in the North America region group. And overwhelmingly, the cities will have said that equity, social equity, is a major urban resilience challenge for us. And everything else can fall into place under social equity. But then we hear from our colleagues in Africa, their challenge is water, right? And then we hear from our European colleagues and they're like, our challenge is heat. So the ability to, you know, kind of bring all of those different perspectives together, but still drive an agenda that brings a global perspective that is relevant at the local level or at our regional level is really impactful. And then, like I said, the peer-to-peer learning from international cities, I mean, as different as we are, we're also very similar, regardless of our boundaries or where we're located. And I find that even aside from participating in the Global Steering Committee, Dallas is part of a State Department funded program called Cities Forward that's led by ICLE. And we're paired with Guatemala City, and we provide them technical assistance of how we implemented our Resilient Dallas strategy, how we're implementing CCAP. And the thing is, like, on our biweekly calls, I find that our departments learn more from Guatemala City, and it's like, oh, you're actually giving us technical assistance, right? And it's just the ability to essentially make those borders non-existent and demonstrate that, you know, regardless of what country you're working in, some of our issues will be the same. It's just a matter of how we go approach it. But also we have a large Guatemalan population here in Dallas. And so, you know, bringing that global perspective is really important for us. And then finally, it's also, you know, participating in these quote unquote clubs or organizations gives us a way to access philanthropic funding that otherwise we wouldn't. Right. So like Resilient Cities Network has access to international funds. They have access to donors or like other organizations who are looking for ways to invest in proven urban resilience initiatives. And without participation in this, we would never know that. Right. And then in the context of the struggle that we have with federal dollars essentially going away for some of these projects, when we look at ARPA and then looking at inaccessible state funds for some of these very focused type of, or we can't even say DEI, right? If we look beyond our borders here, there's access to so much more funding. And I think that's the beauty of these types of global networks is just creating access and opportunities where we would otherwise not be aware of.
It's interesting we mentioned this too. There's actually been some research within the last, I don't know, 6 months or so on the relationship between membership in those kinds of, again, for lack of a better word, club, Resilient Cities Network, C40 Cities, those types of organizations, and credit quality. And I think what they're finding is that there's a pretty clear relationship between membership and improved credit quality, because I think investors tend to see that kind of public commitment to it as a real clear sticking, you know, commitment device. If you are out there publicly committing to these kinds of goals and committing resources to it, and there's consequences for making a public commitment and then going back on that commitment, now that's very different than saying we're committed to this and then not having that kind of external accountability, which seems perhaps even more important in the political situation that you're in, you know, where that accountability might, you know, come from elsewhere. So it's interesting. It seems that there may even be some pretty tangible economic benefits now from membership in those sorts of clubs based on some of the recent research.
That would be a very interesting research stream. Additional, you know, looking at the local level, and now you've got my brain thinking about, okay, what can I add as a future research project?
Yes, indeed. And speaking of, we heard a rumor here at the Public Money Pod that you've been working on some research of your own, of the doctoral dissertation sort. Can you confirm or not confirm that? And if so, tell us a little bit more about that research.
I can confirm. I actually just passed my comprehensive exam, and I am now getting ready to write my proposal so that I can be ABD finally. but yeah, going to take a quick left turn. And so while I do a lot of work in resilience and climate, right, I also on the other side do a lot of work on the digital divide. And so my research and a lot of the coursework that I've been doing, research I've been doing, is looking at truly understanding the digital divide. So different perspectives. One is, how do we get to that point, or like, what is it going to take to change the viewpoint of like internet being a private good or a luxury item, and seeing it as a utility that everyone has, you know, should have access to, right? And then another aspect of my research is looking at the administrative burden of some of the federal subsidy programs, most recently the Affordable Connectivity Program, that provided a $30 subsidy to households to $30 subsidy to households to alleviate some of the cost burden of their internet bill, monthly bill, right? But when you look at how households actually access that subsidy, you have to complete two different applications. One is to the FCC, and then another is to your internet service provider. You first have to get approved by the FCC, and then you take your code and go to your internet service provider and say, hey, I have a code, so now take $30 off my internet bill. But when you're applying to the FCC, there's so many different documents needed, right? And so just thinking about it from like, how can we simplify this process and make it easier for people to access these types of funds? Although the Affordable Connectivity Program has not been renewed for funding recently, I'm sure there will be some future iteration of it. How do we make the future iterations much easier to access for our most vulnerable population, so that there is not that burden? How do we change the mindset and support our most vulnerable populations to access all of these resources and not make it harder for them? And kind of taking learnings from decades of research on welfare, right? Welfare programs. There's so much there that tells us, you know, how we should change. But then also thinking about the internet is supposed to be this neutralizing technology, but it's actually creating even bigger chasm between the haves and the have-nots. So thinking about that along those lines too. So yeah, as you can see, I still got a lot of things to work out for my proposal, and kind of like really focusing my my research agenda. But that along the lines of digital divide is kind of where I'm going.
Well, thanks so much, Genesis Covino, Chief of Staff and Resilience Officer for the City of Dallas, Texas. We really appreciate you giving us some time on the Public Money Pod.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks again to Genesis for that really, really great conversation. We covered so much. It was such a good example of how when you talk about resilience, you're talking about a bunch of different things. It's not just pocketed into one category. The Rip of the Headlines piece I pulled this week kind of talks about the other part of America that isn't necessarily having to deal with these very expensive climate change issues, at least not to the degree that places like Dallas or coastal cities are. It's an article from The Atlantic called America's Climate Boomtowns Are Waiting. And it's written by Abraham Lustgarten, and it talks about how rising temperatures could push millions of people up north. I'm going to read what we call in journalism the nut graph, which says that as climate change brings disasters and increasingly unlivable conditions to growing swaths of the U.S., it also has the potential to remake America's economic landscape. So extreme heat, drought, fires in the South and West do present an opportunity for much of the North. Tens of millions of Americans may move in response to these changes, fleeing coasts and the countryside for larger cities and more temperate climates. In turn, the extent to which our planet's crisis can present an economic opportunity or even reimagining will largely depend on where people wind up and the ways they are welcomed or perhaps scorned. A couple of other big points from the article. The article focuses on the Great Lakes region, which includes cities like Detroit, Milwaukee, Cleveland, Buffalo, Duluth. They're seen as a potential destination for climate migration. These cities all peaked decades ago during the industrial boom period. they have the capacity to definitely accommodate more people, given that their population, their cities that are built for much population that then lives there now. The article also highlights the work of Beth Gibbons, who's an urban planner and specialist in climate adaptation, and she believes a significant portion of the population will move to the Great Lakes region. And the article quotes Gibbons as saying, "There's no future in which many people don't head here. The only question is whether we don't just end up being surprised by it." So she seems pretty certain. And to be honest, I've heard the idea of climate migration, climate refugees. It's been around for quite some time. And I've certainly not the first time I've heard people talking about Rust Belt cities or former industrial boom cities benefiting from people migrating away from coastal areas. And so this kind of talks about the other side of the coin we heard a lot about one city that's pumping a lot of money into climate adaptation and other types of resilience projects. But now we also have cities that could be spending money or doing their own adaptation for a population boom. And I just find, I find it all pretty interesting, and it's certainly all connected. Either way, you're spending money. I thought it was a good thing to also point out. It's definitely a related side effect as to what's going on, and certainly something for these cities to rightfully focus on. What were some of the things that stood out to you, Justin, in the article?
Yeah, it's a really interesting piece. I had seen it before we talked about it as a good candidate for Rip from the Headlines. As you can imagine, a lot of people here in the Great Lakes region are talking about this, and it's part of a conversation that's been going on for a long time. When you talk to the economic development people in Milwaukee, Buffalo, Chicago, places like that, it has been interesting to see how their strategy has really shifted in the last few years away from what it used to be, which was the sort of smokestack chasing, offering a lot of tax incentives, trying to recruit big employers, those kinds of supports, so to speak, for economic development, knowing that they were competing with Sunbelt cities for the same kinds of economic development opportunities. The tone really has changed as of late, and now it's in the future. You as a business are going to need certain things just to be able to operate, like access to clean water, like a reliable electricity grid, like as few as possible major winter and other storm events and so forth. And as the climate shifts, of course, it does raise that question of whether the places that have all those ingredients, become that much more attractive. Author of this piece certainly seems to think so. And so there are a lot of people in this part of the world who have kind of shifted that now to their strategy is to essentially say, trust us, thank us later. This is the place you want to be. It's been interesting though, too. I think there's a lot of people who aren't there yet. It's just a little too abstract still. But one of the things that you have seen a lot of lately is, I think, a shift in the way that we think about economic development. There was a really interesting report done not that long ago by a group called HIP Investors, which is a group that does sort of ESG reporting and metrics for fixed income generally, for corporate bonds and a lot for municipal bonds. And they did a report, they were part of a team that did a report not that long ago that went through and identified the parts of the country where the manufacturing infrastructure is best prepared to shift into the manufacturing required for a sustainable economy, manufacturing solar panels, manufacturing heat pumps, manufacturing a lot of the kinds of hardware that you'll need for climate adaptation. And not surprisingly, the places that jump to the top of the list are Buffalo, Cleveland, Milwaukee, places like that. And so that seems to have been the thing that is a little bit of a bridge, a little bit of an intermediate step where the economic development folks in those types of communities can say, yes, let's get on board with that first. Let's provide some immediate benefits to this shift toward resilience. And then if those industries are in place and if we can get some wins there, then we'll start to believe the idea that we can become a climate destination. Meanwhile, as you said, you have places like Dallas that aren't going to go down without a fight. They're prepared to do what they need to do to make their communities as hospitable as possible. And so it's going to be interesting. The reality is, I think you probably need both, right? You probably need both of those things happening. And at the end of the day, people will go where they think it's best for them to go. And that's a big part of why local government finance is a really interesting thing to study. Thanks again to our Season 2 sponsors, Build America Mutual, MuniPro, Odyssey Advisors, and the Government Finance Officers Association. Public Money Pod is a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy, where we are proudly produced by Hannah Burnick. You can learn more about the center and its work at munifinance.uchicago.edu. That's munifinance.uchicago.edu. You can learn more about Liz Farmer's work at her Substack, Long Story Short. That's Long Story Short. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Public Money Pod.